Hi, I'm Steve Clements, and I have a question. Can America's drug abuse epidemic, which kills more than 100,000 people each year, be traced to one family of billionaires? Let's get to the bottom line. By the time this show ends, five Americans will have died from a drug overdose. By the end of this day and every day, the number is going to be about 300. It's one of the country's top killers. More than guns, more than car accidents, and more than suicides. And it's everywhere, from posh suburbs to farm country. For decades, survivors of addiction and relatives of victims have been trying to hold one company to account, Purdue Pharma. That company, privately owned by a billionaire family, the Sacklers, has been in the painkiller business for decades. But when they released a powerful drug in the 1990s, OxyContin, drug abuse skyrocketed, along with Purdue's profits. For years, government prosecutors tried to sue the Sacklers to pay for the damage to communities and states across the country. Just recently, a settlement was just reached where the family will pay $6 billion in return for immunity from any future opioid lawsuits. But will it help? Or is America beyond fixing when it comes to the steep decline into drug addiction? Today, we're speaking with Barry Meyer, a former journalist with the New York Times, who was among the first to cover the opioid epidemic. His book, Painkiller, An Empire of Deceit and the Origin of America's Opioid Epidemic, is being turned into a Netflix drama that comes out this August. Barry, thank you so much for joining us. I have been reading you and your chronicle of this horrible story for decades. I think you began writing about what was going on almost 25 years ago, if I'm right. And I'm just interested in how you were turned on so quickly to the impact of what has become just a national horrible epidemic.
Well, first of all, Steve, thanks very much for having me on. And yes, you make me feel like an old man, which I am, because it was almost 22 years ago, 23 years ago, that I got a tip from an editor at the Times who came up to me one day and said that a pharmacy regulator in the Midwest had called him and told him that there was this hot new drug on the street. And what was remarkable about it was that the sales representatives, the people promoting the drug to doctors and pharmacists, were going around and telling them that this painkiller, which was called OxyContin, was designed in a way where it wouldn't be abused. It was much less prone to abuse than existing painkillers. And that started the trail. I mean, initially, a colleague and I started making phone calls to druggists and law enforcement officials. And basically, I think it was in early 2001, we published at the Times our first story about this new drug that was being promoted as a wonder drug, but was in fact becoming the hottest drug of abuse on the street. And from there, it just became a trail that I followed and followed and followed.
I'm wondering what went wrong. What was the government fail in this? As we're all talking about the Sacklers getting immunity for $6 billion. And by the way, folks, they're going to remain very rich still. What did the government allow to happen?
Well, you know, Steve, this is sort of an example where there's not one simple answer. Because it was a failure on so many different levels by so many different people of both oversight and regulation and honest mistakes also. I mean, I think it's important to realize that, you know, OxyContin is a drug that has very useful purposes. You know, it can be used for cancer treatment, for treatment of end-of-life pain or terrible chronic existing pain. So it's a valuable drug. But what the FDA did and what was a unique and mind-blowing mistake was approve authorized a recommendation or a suggestion that OxyContin, because it had this special time-release formulation to it, could be used to treat basically any kinds of pain. And this became like the golden ticket for Purdue to start marketing this for all kinds of pain, back pain, dental pain, sports injuries, you name it. And so this drug seeped into sort of the breadbasket of American medicine and was prescribed and prescribed and overprescribed and quickly made its way out onto the street. The other issue that was going on at the same time was that there was this philosophical idea in the United States that was being promoted, by Purdue and others, that pain was being undertreated, that people were being allowed to suffer needlessly. And while that was true in a limited number of cases, this became part of the drumbeat, if you will, for Purdue to convince doctors that they should be prescribing this drug more aggressively.
What is the ecosystem of drug prescriptions? And I'm not going to mention the doctor, but I remember 20 years ago when I would visit the doctor and have, you know, a nasal infection, have something, as the doctor would reach into a bag of some stuff the pharmacy, you know, or the drug companies had given them, and literally drop in my hands a bunch of, like, samples and just say, take these home. And I, at that time, had not read about Purdue and how it had basically innovated a very new drug distribution, or at least drug test-out system to pharmacists and doctors around the country. But can you share with our viewers what the innovations were that Purdue brought to the distribution of this drug?
Well, you know, it sort of traces back to one of the things I found most fascinating when I was researching the book and researching the story. And that was, there were three Sackler brothers, and the sort of the scion of the family, if you will, was Arthur Sackler. And in the late 1950s, early 60s, Arthur Sackler created something that hadn't existed before, which was basically the advertising of prescription drugs to pharmacists and the use of sales representatives to go out and basically market drugs to pharmacists. And then the recruiting of doctors who were then being paid to market drugs, to market these same drugs to their colleagues. So he essentially created this ecosystem that we live in today, where there is a pill for every ill, and we're confronted by these advertisements everywhere we look, magazines, television, you name it. And prior to the advent of OxyContin, these kind of massive advertising campaigns were reserved for, you know, kind of commonplace medicines, you know, like your hay fever medicine or a heart medicine or something like that. But OxyContin became the first case where the techniques that were used to promote kind of everyday drugs were used to promote what was arguably the most potentially addictive medication sold in the marketplace.
I just want to show you a chart, Barry, for a minute to our audience, of national drug-involved overdose deaths between 1999 and this is to 2021. So I imagine the numbers may have increased, particularly during the COVID period, now into 2023. So you have more than a fivefold increase in the deaths related to that. How, I mean, I get, and it's a steady rise. I'm just interested because you covered this so well, and I remember reading your New York Times pieces. Did America wake up at any certain point and say, wow, something really bad is going on? Or did we just sort of take it on? I mean, I'm just interested in when did the alarms and, you know, folks with hair on fire begin to understand that this was a serious issue?
Tragically, it didn't happen for a very, very, very long time. You know, I can remember back at the beginning when there were, you know, tens of thousands of overdose deaths, being shocked by this and expecting that, you know, lawmakers and regulators and the government itself would crack down and try to do something about this problem. In fact, they didn't. One of the great travesties took place in 2007 when the Justice Department brought a criminal case against Purdue Pharma and three of its top executives. But rather than sending them to prison, which the local prosecutors actually wanted to do, they got their legs cut off from underneath them by the Justice Department higher-ups, the political appointees, who insisted that, well, you couldn't send a white-collar executive to prison. And as a result of that, it became a green light for every other drug company selling opioids to flood rural America, middle America, with tens of thousands of these pain pills. And then later on, in that chart that you're alluding to, while the overdose deaths from prescription medications, legal medications, began to plateau, you had the introduction of illicit forms of fentanyl and other powerful opioids that were even more deadly. And that has accounted for this continuing rise over the past decade nearly in overdose deaths. I mean, I think the mix of deaths between overdose deaths from prescription drugs and overdose deaths from illicit drugs has changed to where now the majority are coming from illicit forms of fentanyl and other types of counterfeit drugs.
Well, you mentioned fentanyl, Barry, but was the OxyContin story the pathway to fentanyl, which is, I guess, different because that's not something that's being distributed, as far as I know, by major drug companies. But, it, you know, do you see a logical link between them? And just love your insights on how do you unplug it?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it is fair to say, and I'm not the only one who's said it, you know, the government has sort of said it in reports, that the over-marketing, the illegal marketing of OxyContin planted a seed that sort of became the springboard to this growing opioid crisis within the United States. At a certain point, however, the mixture changes, the people change, the people seeking these drugs start seeking other drugs when there are restrictions placed on the availability of prescription drugs. They migrate to illegal drugs and back and forth, depending on what the prevailing legal ethics are and what the supply of these drugs are. So it's a complicated situation. I mean, you can't take today's drug situation and say, well, Purdue, you're responsible for all these deaths. Because I think we have to realize that fentanyl, illegal fentanyl, is killing Americans in a way that is horrifying. And we have to take steps beyond the simple political back and forth about what is happening on the southern border.
Right. Tell us a little bit about the family, the Sackler family behind this. You know, reading your book, and I'm going to tell our audience, I'm not surprised at all that Netflix is making a docudrama out of your book. It reads a little bit like Succession, the show Succession. That's HBO. But you've got the sense of this powerful family, differences and disputes within the family. They were a power family funding some major charities around the nation. I'd just love to kind of hear where this presence and their billions of dollars went over the lines of what I would call insidiousness.
It's a fact. You're right, Steve. The family is fascinating. And one of the pleasures, although one might say it was a perverse pleasure, was learning about this family, learning about how this family evolved into the powers they became, and also the extraordinary secretive nature of this family, how they never stepped out from the shadows, unlike the family in Succession, who seemed to, you know, crave the limelight. The Sacklers were very different. They hid behind phalanxes of lawyers and public relations officials. And what they wanted to be known for was not making money off of your drugs or potentially addicting drugs, but for using their wealth to endow museums, medical schools, and put the Sackler name up in bright lights. You know, I grew up in New York. I'm a New York kid. And I can remember going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art many, many times, to the Sackler Wing, because I loved archaeology, and I went there to see the exhibits of the Temple of Dendur. And when I was researching, you know, Painkiller, I came across the fact that Arthur Sackler had financed all of this, and that his memorial service was held at that facility by the Temple of Dendur. And to me, that spoke volumes of, you know, how the powerful, how the rich can mold public perceptions of their personalities by throwing money around, by buying their, you know, putting their names on different places. And what was extraordinary as well is, again, in watching the arc of the story play out, was how this all came apart. And it didn't really come apart because of my work or the work of other journalists. It came apart for the Sacklers in terms of their public reputation when a photographer, Nan Golden, launched a campaign against them and began to hold demonstrations at all the major museums where the Sackler name appeared, and basically said, I will not exhibit in this museum if you continue to accept money from the Sacklers. And she hit them in the place where they lived. And the results for the family's name were devastating as a result.
Well, there has been this lawsuit by attorneys general of 9 states suing the Sackler family, suing the interests behind OxyContin and this opioid epidemic. And now we have a settlement, $6 billion, significant amount of money. Do you think justice has been served? What's accomplished in this lawsuit, which now gives the family immunity from any further lawsuits?
Well, I think when we think about justice as a concept, at least how I think about it, is that people who commit crimes go to jail or face some repercussions for their crimes. I'm not saying the Sacklers committed crimes, but what I will say is that no one associated with Purdue Pharma, be it an executive, a sales rep, whomever, an owner, has spent a day in jail. So this settlement is not about justice. It's about a transfer of wealth. And there is some virtues to be had through that transfer of wealth, which include the payment for drug addiction treatment services and other steps that hopefully will ameliorate the drug abuse problem as it exists now in the United States. But the entire concept I find astonishing, because essentially what the courts have said and now affirmed recently is that if you are so wealthy that you can essentially pay for protection against future lawsuits by contributing to a bankruptcy proceeding, that's fine as far as the courts are concerned. But I think what it kind of shockingly does is establish a two-tiered system of justice, of fairness, of equity, that most people will never be able to take advantage of, because they're not going to have $6 billion lying around to exchange for protection.
You spoke to so many people who slipped from painkillers to addiction, to abuse, to overdose, the real people. And I guess I just want to hear from you what we should know about the people that are on the other end of this, that suffered. They see this settlement that has happened. But as we look at these problems, we look forward, what should we be thinking about these these victims of this terrible situation?
You know, there are two sets of people, two patients, if you will, that are in this story. One are the people who suffer from pain, who need to be treated. The other group are the people who become addicted to these drugs, either through being prescribed them for addiction to pain or through recreational use. And we need to recognize that this is not a group of good guys or bad guys. These are people who are both suffering from illnesses. There are different types of illnesses that need to be treated as illnesses. And we need to see them all with compassion and come up with solutions that, one, provide treatment for patients in pain without risking addiction, and provide treatments for people who become addicted so their lives don't spiral down further and their lives can be reclaimed in a productive way.
Barry, just real quick, tell us about the Netflix docudrama. That's the next step for your storytelling of, you know, one of the great horrible eras in American history. Tell us what it's like. Who's getting the roles, and are you happy with the direction it's going? What will we learn?
So the stars are Matthew Broderick, who plays Richard Sackler, who was kind of the head of Purdue Pharma when OxyContin was being marketed, and Uzo Obuda, who plays a composite and an imaginary character who becomes sort of the investigator who uncovers the crimes. And she's working for the government, and it's about her relationships with other people in the government. I have had an opportunity to see the final cuts of the series. It's a six-part series. Each episode's about an hour or so. And I liked it. And more importantly, my wife, who's probably heard enough about this story and doesn't want to hear me talk about it anymore, was engrossed by it. It's different. It's different from what I expected to be. It sort of takes the story to another level, and I'm going to be very interested to see how people react to it.
Thank you so much for your candor, for your work, for your many decades of focus on this terrible plight. So Barry Meyer, author of Painkiller, soon to be a Netflix docudrama on America's opioid epidemic. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it.
So what's the bottom line? Drug and alcohol abuse is not just an American problem, but the sheer scale of America's drug addiction story is just huge. Besides the millions of lives lost and families ruined, the cost to the U.S. economy is now in the hundreds of billions of dollars every year. But the problem is not just the Sacklers or Purdue Pharma, despite the disgraceful place they now hold in modern U.S. history. As we saw in the trial, the whole chain is broken. Drug company executives, doctors, pharmacists, lawmakers, the police, and pain patients, drug abusers, and kids just looking for a thrill. There's no way to fix all of that easily. Add to the mix America's healthcare system, where some insurance companies would rather just pay for a pill to ease your pain than go through the time and expense of actually fixing you. And you have a truly toxic cocktail. That's why there are no signs America is putting a lid on its opioid epidemic anytime soon. And that, sadly, is the bottom line.